Well, I'm now going to quote to you from an article in the online strategic analysis firm Stratfor to give you a taste of the fascinating research my next guest has carried out about student movements around the world. Student protests, he wrote, lay bare the social and cultural layers that move beneath the surface of geopolitics, much like subsurface currents flow beneath the waves of the oceans. Even if we regard the state as the highest level of global policy making and interaction, these social undercurrents are what move the generations, ideologies and cultural changes that shape the constraints under which states operate. However, successful student movements, he went on to say, needed to galvanise the other areas of civil societies in order to expand. And as the Hong Kong protesters say they plan to take their demonstrations to Beijing during the APEC Leaders Forum next week, we take a look at student movements over the years, ones that made a difference and those that failed to create change. Sim Tak is now a military analyst for Stratfor, and he joins me now via Skype. Sim, welcome to Saturday Extra.
Thank you very much.
Could I ask you, how did you get interested in student protests?
Well, particularly my personal path, being part of a student club back when I was a student, has been a big influence in that. But other than that, when studying geopolitics, like, there's a really important social dimension to that, which consists of these ideological, ethnical currents that really dominate the direction of a society and, as a consequence, the states that those societies are a part of. And student movements, while they are not determining factor of those social patterns, they are a key catalyst that either show what direction those currents are going or that actually give direction to those larger currents.
So they're a clue, they're a sort of marker boy, you say, more than some others? Is that what your thesis is?
In some cases, yes. For example, when we're looking at the Hong Kong protests specifically, these protests are not bringing up something new that wasn't there before. They are pretty much taking existing social pressures, bringing those up to the surface, and whether or not these protest movements are successful in what they are demanding right now, those currents will continue to exist. But when we look back in history, for example, the 68 protests in Europe, what we saw there was actually a new ideology coming forward from the student movement that they brought to the forefront. And even though at the time they didn't succeed to get their demands met, those actual changes that they wanted to achieve became an actual point of discussion and over time have heavily influenced the social dimension of Europe.
Yes, well, now we'll come back to that, but just let's stick with this, the Hong Kong one, which is totally fascinating. I just heard the other day of people who had been there and had said, for instance, it's very orderly. I mean, there are three separate areas, of course, of protest, but in one of the ones they went to, there were study areas set up where the students could set aside to study and proper food being served. Like, it was a little subculture that was very effectively run.
And that ties into one of the really important things about why students are able to play this important role as well. There's a large logistical element that goes into mounting these protests. And when you're a student, you have no immediate loss of income when you spend time in these protests rather than, you know, other people having to go to work, for example. So students can actually take that time. The fact that they're actually studying in the streets shows that they can even prolong this further because they're actually able to fulfill their basic duties, if you can call it that. So this whole advantage, the resource of time that students have available is one of the things that makes them more of a militant class of society, if that makes sense.
Mm. Does it make them more dangerous if you're the established order?
I wouldn't say dangerous necessarily, but authoritarian regimes, for example, have always been very, very wary of what moves in student movements and what kind of threat they could pose to them. If we think of Sudan, for example, where you have President Bashir running a really tight ship, but then once in a while, when social pressures mount, it's usually the students from the Khartoum universities that actually come to the streets and start challenging that rule.
And of course, it was in Indonesia, it absolutely brought down Suharto. Well, but it was the final straw. I suppose that's your point, that they represent a sort of almost like the pressure valve of a build-up
exactly.
of attitudes.
And often that's also the specific point where the the make or break element in their protest comes across is whether they manage to actually pull other layers of society into their protests and force their demands onto the ruling class. And oftentimes student protests will pop up and just disappear because even though those social demands exist within a society, students alone aren't necessarily able to impose force on the ruling class.
And so how do they galvanize other areas of civil society? Like, how do they get people who are in the workforce who would lose money if they participated? How do they get them to come on board?
So there's a few ways that that's been achieved in the past. I mean, one of the ways is by simply coming to the street and actually showing that there is an existing movement, kind of the socialist idea of the spearhead of the revolution, if you will, where students will come to the street, show that there is actual substance to these demands, hoping that other people feel less of a barrier to actually join in. If people think that there's more credibility to actually achieving something, they will be less concerned about the risk that they take. Other ways that this has been done is actually by quite directly engaging in forming alliances. And then when we're looking at the Hong Kong protests, for example, we're actually seeing those student groups talking to local businesses and other people that have an actual stake in that society and that might actually want to support this.
Radio National's Religion and Ethics Report, our own network's very good sister program, looked at how religion is playing a crucial role in these Hong Kong protests. And the 17-year-old leader, Joshua Wong, comes from an evangelical Christian background. And the founders, I understand, of Occupy Central are mostly from Hong Kong's growing Protestant community, this very, very interesting phenomenon of Protestantism growing in the Northern Asian region. Now, would you say that contributes, when you examine the student movements that have succeeded in change versus those that haven't, is this a factor?
I would say it is, yes. Just as any type of political ideology, religion is one of those things that shapes social groups and that also compels them to actually try and achieve change.
Just to sort of follow on from that, this report that the student protesters are threatening to cross into the mainland to protest at the APEC forum, which is going to include President Obama next week. Now, I can't imagine they'll be allowed to go across to the mainland, but can you imagine that is likely to occur?
I think there is some very, very significant constraints on that successfully taking place. If you look at the situation of Hong Kong has, in comparison to mainland China, been a much more liberated society than that of China itself. And then when looking at the mainland, this isn't the first time that people are talking about bringing the umbrella protests from Hong Kong to the mainland. There have been previous attempts which basically amounted to nothing at all. And the Chinese state has a really, really strict policy on the way it deals with protests like this from a security standpoint. And we've even seen reports of calls from the central government in Beijing to force the Hong Kong government to actually use more force against these protests. So in the end, I would say that the whole dynamic that allows these protests to exist is not present in mainland China the way it is in Hong Kong.
One of the issues I did want to just bring up with you was the what I presume you say has been an unsuccessful effort by students, which was Iran. That whole upswelling of the Green Movement in 2008-09, which for a while looked as though it really had possibilities, and of course it was crushed so utterly viciously, and it seemed, I just wonder how you see it, to have gone away. Now, The Economist, for instance, this week has just written about the gradual retreat of clericalism. Their thesis anyway is that clericalism is on the decline and that a secularism is on the rise and that Iran is changing, and if everybody just waits for Iran to change fully because the nature of its society, you know, a very good outcome could be achieved without any hostilities and so on, and that it'd be all for the best, the long-term best for everyone concerned. So, I mean, how do you characterise the student movement as it existed in Iran against an incredibly implacable foe?
Well, they're actually a great example of what we've been talking about before, where student movements aren't necessarily immediately successful at achieving their direct demands. But in the end, the fact that these student movements were able to mount this kind of pressure on the ruling class in Iran, that also has to make that ruling class very aware of those existing social pressures. And you can't keep going through that process. You can't keep fighting your own civilians if you want to be a stable state and to have actual pragmatic governance. So in the end, and this is something that's happened in a lot of other places too, even if student protests are being cracked down, the fact that they were able to ring that alarm bell to bring up a social demand forces the ruling class to go back, take a look at what they're doing and say, like, maybe there are a few things we can change to mitigate the effect, to kind of ease into this and make sure we don't face really volatile situations like this in the future.
And are you also saying that it sends a message to the middle classes that who certainly it was broader than just a student movement, if you recall, but are you saying that it again acts as a sort of marker boy for the middle classes to look again at their own society?
Yes, very much so. And in a way, the actions of the government with easing the tension on certain aspects also plays into keeping those other classes that are not students from actually joining in the student movements or in their protests by, again, lowering the advantage that could be gained from taking the risk of taking part in this kind of protest.
Look, we might just finish going just quickly back to China. Then I wonder what you think the impact of the rising middle class of China of these student protests in Hong Kong. I don't know how much they're hearing about them, of course. There's a lot of censorship. But what's your instinct?
I think one of the important things to think of here is that we don't necessarily need to look at direct implications of these protests on the Chinese middle class as it is now. But I think it's important to identify that there's a certain trend in social demands and things that the society wants their state to look like. At some point, we will see this emerge in mainland China. At some point, this middle class will have more and more demands, and the state will have to accommodate those or face similar protests in Beijing.
I just before I let you go, I can't resist asking you, though, about whether they might look like the Cultural Revolution, which the harbinger of another Cultural Revolution, that ghastly, you know, utterly traumatic time for China, which was in essence fanned by students, led really by Mao Zedong, but fanned by students, way out of control.
Although in that case, students very much took the side of the state and actually went on to reinforce what the state had been trying to do, specifically Mao. And that's kind of the opposite position of what we have now, where what the hardliner government in Beijing wants is absolutely not what these student protests are demanding.
So, in effect, student movements can work both for the state and anti the state?
Yes, very much so. And in a way, when student movements are immediately successful in gaining their demands, they are actually the ones that form the state. And then that's prior to the Green Revolution in Iran. The actual current regime came to power in the 1979 revolution, where students actually played a big part. And for example, Ahmadinejad, the former president of Iran, was one of those student leaders at the time stormed the U.S. embassy and took the Americans hostage. Mm. So there is a cycle between these students and government that can occur as well.
Very interesting. Thank you very much for joining us.
Pleasure's all mine.
Sim Tak is a military analyst attached to the global intelligence firm based in Austin, Texas, called Stratfor. And if you haven't already listened to the Religion and Ethics report about the Umbrella Revolution in Religion, you can download it from the Radio National website, by the way.